In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
A lot of them aren't even pretending to be in charge.
Slow the testing down.
Remove him from office.
No justice, no peace.
Cast a vote that will make you proud.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen.
Hello, and welcome to the Betches Sup Podcast. I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Brian Russell Smith.
I'm Sammy Sage.
And the Betches Sup Podcast is your daily rundown of all the craziest shit going on in the news, brought to you by your four funniest friends.
Which is us!
Happy Friday, guys. We're 11 days out. How's it feel?
I'm completely numb to the situation.
Yeah.
It
alternately feels like it's so close, and like I'm like, it's so far, and I just want it to be happening now.
I don't like feel any sense of like, okay, if I believed that like it would be over and done and decided and like no more drama on November 4th, I'd be like, okay, I'd be like excited. But because to me, there's like no definitive endpoint of this, like it could be November 4th. It could, like, who knows how long we'll be just like in a kind of purgatory for. So I'm not like, I'm not like counting on the 11 day thing. I'm just like, all right, we're just going along and we'll see. And maybe we'll get our lives back in January, or maybe we won't. We'll see.
I know the electors count their votes on the 14th, I think, of December, right?
Something like that. Yeah, somewhere around that. I don't feel comfortable at any time of it. You know, like,
overall,
like, I am anxious person, like, and it's just being heightened, and you know, and like even like while I sleep, I'm like, oh, I'm sweating because I like dreamt about the debate last night. It's not fun.
That's horrible.
You have Trump derangement syndrome.
I do. That's it's like I can't deal. Like, why are these? Well, it's over now. But why do they have to go till 11 p.m.? That is fucking ridiculous. Like, I need to go. I go to bed at 10 p.m. So like, I need. I don't want. And then I don't want to stay up again for another hour. And like try and decompress. I usually just go to bed, and I was just like miserable.
Democracy.
Yeah, and I wake up at 6
sleeps.
In a panic, no matter what. Never sleeps.
That's or democracy dies in darkness is, I guess, more appropriate. But yeah, I watched.
Depending on your mood.
I watched like the first almost hour of Borat after the debate, and then I fell asleep. I couldn't make it to the Giuliani scene, but I finished this morning, so I'm excited to hear people's reactions to it.
Oh goodness. Okay. I don't know if I'm excited to watch, but it's on my list. And was like, oh, I'll watch a bunch of cute Halloween movies over the weekend. But maybe I should.
I'm like, I want to see it, but I just like, I don't want to see Rudy Giuliani behaving in a sexual manner. Like, I just don't.
Yeah.
I don't need to see his like horny face. Like,
I believe he's a creep without seeing that. Like,
honestly, it was worth seeing.
You should good. That makes me not dread.
It's like not as, I don't want to set any expectations for everyone. Just it's a piece of Americana that must be seen.
Got it. That sounds great. That's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
So last night, of course, was the final debate of the 2020 presidential election. You guys, we've been doing this since June 2019, when they had 20 candidates and two nights of debates.
Oh, so tired.
So tired. I think that's why last night honestly felt like a breeze. It felt speedy because it's just been 90 commercial-free minutes as opposed to two nights of two-hour debates with people I barely know.
Oh my God. And like they were all competing to speak Spanish and like, and Marianne Williamson was like, I'm a ghost. And we were like, oh my God.
Yeah. I applauded last night when it ended. I was like, because I can't sit down while I watch them anymore for some reason. Like, so my boy Antonio was like laying on the couch with the dog, like chillaxing. And I'm just like standing up. I'm like, oh, he's lying. He's lying. And then it ended. And I'm just like, I like clapped. I was just like, it was very cathartic.
Are we getting a debate TikTok for last night?
Oh, maybe soon.
That was the last time we're going to have to watch Donald Trump debate, whether he wins mm-hmm. or loses. Because if he wins, even if he becomes a dictator, then he still won't debate again. So we're
that's true.
We're not going to have to watch him debate again. That was the last
time. I didn't know how you were going to get around the fact that he could win and then steal every subsequent election, but that's exactly it. We just won't. Yeah, why would he debate?
So we at least know that we will not have to watch him debate anyone ever again.
It could have been the last presidential debate ever.
Right. That's
really
also
finding
true.
The finding
true.
The silver linings here, guys.
In any event, it was Donald Trump's final debate. So his last chance to persuade the public that he's better than Joe Biden in any way. As of yesterday, I think 50 million people have already voted. Trump seemed to understand that he couldn't be like an actual infant. It seems like maybe he graduated to like toddler or mm-hmm. pre-K. What are our general impressions? Was it a good debate, both objectively and just relatively to the other debates? Sammy, what do you think?
Well, to answer that question, you'd have to define good debate. I don't know the answer to that question. But is there such thing as a good debate? I don't know. I think that like everyone is giving the president a lot of credit because he didn't like literally dive at Biden and like physically attack him in a rabid fashion. Like, I don't think we should be giving brownie points just because he wasn't as crazy or crazier than last time, which is the bar that we measure him by. Like, as long as he's not as crazy as he's ever been, we tend to give him credit. And I don't want to give him credit because he said a host of insane things last night. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing, he lied. I believe Daniel Dale, the fact checker from CNN, said that he lied more than in the first debate. So like, no, he was not better than in the first debate.
How do you talk less but lie more?
He was equally terrible. And I'm so sick of watching this infant exist in front of me. Like, I just want him to go away.
Yeah, I would actually personally say that I preferred the other debate because at least it actually represented what we're looking at. Like, what was the Jake Tapper mm-hmm. quote? Like, a shit show inside of a train wreck, inside of a dumpster fire. Like, that's what we actually are dealing with. And so I honestly would rather see that play out than see the shit show inside of a dumpster fire, inside of a train wreck, put on a suit and wobble around on stage for a while and pretend to be a normal man.
Well, that's why it was so frustrating for me, is because he was trying to say these things. Every time he was speaking, he was trying to say things that were fact, that were actual lies. Like, he was just lying the entire time. He's lying about this like laptop story, which like thankfully with this story is so convoluted that it's not like attainable like to understand. Like, I follow politics and I still don't understand what the argument they're trying to make with these like laptops and stuff. So like, and but like, it's just every sentence out of his fucking mouth was a lie. And like, he kept harping back to this China, the buildings with the small windows, and he's gonna raise taxes. Like, every single thing he was saying was just categorically untrue. And then it was just them being like, that's not, and then it was being Biden like, well, that's not true, this is what's actually happening. And then Trump, and then he would say something that was real, and then Trump would say it wasn't true. So it was like a he said the entire time.
Right. You could also tell that Trump was like looking, he kept looking in the audience and like making eye contact with someone. My personal guess is that it was Ivanka and that she was trying to like keep him under control with her eyes or something by eye fucking him, maybe. Like, because he did go close to crazy shit that you could see mm-hmm. him pull back from, mm-hmm. like when he mentioned Hillary Clinton and he wanted to go there and he almost went there, but then he was like, you could see that something like stopped him. And I mean, the stuff about Joe Biden not being from Scranton and the filthy countries and the least racist, like, he just
least racist.
I'm the least racist person in the room. His entire family is in the room.
Ivanka's more racist.
I mean, like, obviously, it's crazy for him to say that to Kristen Welker, but it's also so funny to be like, I'm the least racist person in the room, and like, your wife is sitting in front of you. All of your children, like...
Right. I think if this was the first, you're right, people are saying, oh, it was a good debate. He seemed disciplined. He seemed like he knew what he wanted to do. But yeah, if this was the first time you'd ever seen Donald Trump, you would be absolutely appalled. You would
I
be
know
appalled.
More about wind than you. Like that's wild. Like that's a thing that we're saying he was restrained.
Right. And he doesn't care about the dead birds. He doesn't care. He does not care about the dead birds.
And it's such a lot stupid about
the
argument.
People whose job it is to pick
the
up the dead
birds. The
birds
hate the windmills.
Which why, I'm sure why? They do, but you know what?
Why is he dying on this hill? Why is he dying on this hill?
With like, the birds on the hill.
Forget the windmill, man. Like, Jesus, move on.
Also, this is bizarre, like, race to the bottom about fracking and, like, Donald Trump trying to catch Joe Biden in, like, he's like, the people in Pennsylvania. Like, he like, has such a simplistic way of thinking that he thinks, like, almost, I think that he thinks that Joe Biden commenting on certain things would be like playing a game of operation, like with like against progressives. Like if he gets too close to certain issues, he thinks that that's going to like screw Joe Biden up and like make him lose. But like, I just don't think that anything sticks to Joe Biden in the same way because like he's been he was the vice president. Like people, very clear who he is. And he like the shady politician thing doesn't stick to him because he's not shady.
Yeah. And I think that was one of his best moments was when he's like, this guy is confused. He doesn't know who he's running against. My name is Joe Biden. Like I beat all those other guys. And it was like, and that pretty much just shut down that line of attack from Trump.
I also thought that was really effective, Brian, when he made a point to say, I notably do not believe those things. And I beat all the people that do. Because I am different.
The left is always being really mean to me because they're mad at me all the time and tweeting at me because I don't
like go
believe
on TikTok. They're all settling for Biden. What are you talking about?
Exactly. Like you live on Twitter, dude. You know what the people are saying.
Right, right. Like we love AOC plus three. We're meh for Joe Biden. Yeah. But we're voting for him. I love Joe Biden.
Yeah, I'm very fond of Joe Biden. But the other thing is that like because Joe Biden was known like as kind of this like gaffe machine, like he'd always say what he'd always make the grave mistake of saying what he really thinks, and like that is what people think of Joe Biden, like so all of this like affability and this like he's kind of like oopsie just says stupid things sometimes, like that is now all working for him because people aren't going to turn around and be like, oh, that slick talker, Joe Biden. Like,
yes. The Trump campaign and the Republicans and the right wing media all lowered the expectations for Joe Biden as well. Like they all said he had dementia. He was sleepy. He was tired. He was old. So all he has to do is not like fall asleep during a debate and not like say something crazy. And he wins.
Even calling him socialist is like all he has to do is be like a tad under socialist and like you don't buy it. Like he's so clearly not.
He didn't even really. And this is also not something he controlled, but like Biden didn't even really stammer that much last night, which I just feel like means he's like feeling good. He knows he's got it. It's going to be fine. Let's get into some of the substance, which there was a decent amount of. So this debate came, there were topics, the topics were the same as the first one, other than they added like a splash of national security and climate change. But the big focus was the pandemic. So Trump promised that the disease was going away, while Biden called for much more aggressive federal action and said there was a dark winter ahead. Let's listen to a clip.
President Trump, your reaction?
I say over soon. I say we're learning to live with it. We have no choice. We can't lock ourselves up in a basement like Joe does. He has the he has the ability to lock himself up. I don't know. He's obviously made a lot of money someplace, but he has this thing about living in a basement. People can't do that. By the way, I, as the president, couldn't do that. I'd love to put myself in the basement or in a beautiful room in the White House and go away for a year and a half until it disappears. I can't do that. And Kirsten, every meeting I had, and I'd meet a lot of families, including Gold Star families and military families, every meeting I had, and I had to meet them. I had to. It would be horrible to have canceled everything. I said, you know, this is dangerous. And you catch it. And, you know, I caught it. I learned a lot. Great doctors, great hospitals. And now I recovered. 99.9 of young people recover. 99% of people recover. We have to recover. We can't close up our nation. We have to open our school, and we can't close up our nation, or you're not going to have a nation.
That's my favorite, when he keeps saying, we won't have a country. Like, our borders are just going to dissolve, or will be occupied because of what's going to happen to the country?
I like the line, he's got this thing about being in the basement. I don't know.
That was my favorite. He's got a lot of money. He's got a lot of money, so he's going in the basement. And it's like, how does that compute?
He's like, I can't go in the basement or a beautiful room in the White House. It's like, you almost...
He does that all the time. Yeah.
Well, his whole job consists of, like, sitting in his room and tweeting. Like,
He went to the bunker.
Right.
And also...
Forgot about that. Wow.
Yeah, it's just...
Why did he do that?
That whole thing where he's like, you got a little... You got money from somewhere. Like, he keeps trying to reference this whatever New York Post Rudy Giuliani thing with the laptop that's going on, but he never actually explains it. So no one knows what the hell he's talking about. He always is like, you're the big man. And it's like, no one knows.
Yeah. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like trying to make it seem like he's trying to like equate it to Hillary Clinton's email somehow. But like, that was more comprehensible, because it's like, she deleted her emails. Why did you delete the emails? This one is like, there was a laptop, and then there was a reference to a man, and it's like, yeah, I don't
follow
the
Moscow mayor's wife.
Yeah, and we're like, what? Who?
Here's the thing. He's also combining all of the scandals that he's made up, that he and the Russians or the Kremlin have made up together. So he confuses them, I think, in his own head. But the other key thing is that, like, literally every single thing he says about Joe Biden is projection.
Yeah.
Like, if all these scandals, like, you're the big man, you're getting money from shady places, like, you're talking about yourself. Those are all sentences that describe what he does.
100%. He's the boyfriend who's cheating on you and then accuses you of cheating all the time. Like, that's his whole thing.
Yeah.
It's also just funny to see him kind of insecure. Like, he's supposed to be the rich president, but he's almost like conceding that. He's almost like, all right, big guy, you got the cash. So supposed to be a billionaire.
Yeah.
Also, when he's such a baby, like, and he's like, he's going to cut Social Security. Like, no, you're going to cut Social Security. Like, when he's like pointing at him across like the frame, and it's just like, you are a toddler in this suit and like 70 something year old man's body.
And when he was doing that, he was like, Joe Biden's a socialist, and he wants to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. And it's like, those are all social programs, you fool. Like,
bragged about the Trillion Trees program.
Yeah. What the Green New Deal is going to cost $100 trillion. It's like, that is a made up number.
No, yeah, he made up absolutely everything. At least I feel like you captured it perfectly in that tweet last night that was like, Joe Biden talked about the American people and us, and Trump just was a victim the whole time. Mm-hmm. And Joe Biden has lost 2 children and a wife. He's had like incredible tragedies. And yet you never hear him say, poor me. I have never heard Joe Biden respond to any criticism. Maybe a little bit when he first started running and he started getting like introduced to the new wave of online scrutiny. He was a little like, but what, me? I'm Joe Biden. But I haven't seen that from him for a while.
No, he really does give the mic over to other people. I remember seeing that at the DNC, like, he allowed so many other people to be highlighted. The way that he speaks about and works with Kamala, he really allows her to be like a shining star next to him. Whereas Donald Trump, it's all about him. It's all about his own personal grievance. It's all about how everyone's mean to him. He's been the victim of this whole time. Everyone's been so mean to him. It's not fair. Life's not fair. Da, da, da. I mean, he's just completely self-centered in every way. He even made fun of Joe Biden. He was like, that's typical politician stuff. When Joe Biden was like looking to camera to be like, you know, your families are hurting. And yeah. he has so little empathy that he couldn't see that. He couldn't see why someone would do yeah. that for any reason other than politics.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Joe Biden is like, he's like a mensch. Like, he's a good guy. And I actually remember like something that actually kind of like changed my perspective on Joe Biden was like around the primaries when everyone was kind of talking about how like Joe Biden had like captured the black vote and like why weren't the other candidates able to do that. And I read this something, a post by someone on social media, and they were basically saying how like the reason like black people know Joe Biden is because they watched him like play, like be the vice president, be like second to a black man for 8 years and always showed him deference and respected him, and they worked hand in hand, and like they would know if Joe Biden was like not able to like defer mm-hmm. to a black man, and that earns him respect in that community, rightfully yeah. so. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just who Joe Biden is as a person. Like I don't think that he sees it as like, I like, you need to respect me because I'm white, like genuine.
Yeah. He doesn't have anything personally at stake in being wrong. You can tell when he does, he gets really animated, but yeah. most of the time he does, he's like, sure. Yeah. What you said, that sounds, what do I know? And it's not a personal attack on it. Whereas Trump sees everything as a personal attack. Another topic that animated discussion a lot was immigration. This came in sort of the broader context of, I mean, all of the just hideous things that have happened in this administration. And days after we learned from a big report that more than 500 migrant children were separated from their parents by the Trump administration and have not been reunited. They cannot locate the parents that they sent back. This president insists that these minors, whether they're separated or not, are well taken care of, as are all of the people in detention. Let's listen to a clip.
These 500 plus kids came with parents. They separated them at the border to make it a disincentive to come to begin with. And guess what? They cannot, it's not coyotes didn't bring them over. Their parents were with them. They got separated from their parents.
Kristen, they did it. We changed the policy.
Their kids were ripped from their arms and separated. And now they cannot find over 500 of sets of those parents, and those kids are alone. Nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. It's criminal. It's criminal.
They are so well taken care of. They're in facilities that were so clean.
But some of them haven't been reunited with their
families. Just ask one question. Who built the cages? I'd love you to ask him that. Who built the cages?
So that last point about the cages and who built them, the New York Times called that claim misleading. So the Obama administration only broke up families at the border in very rare circumstances. Still not good. Such as if there were like questions about the familial relationship or if the person was really their parent or they were trying to abuse the system. But the zero tolerance policy of separating all people who entered the country illegally began with the Trump administration and shoving these people into cages. The Obama administration did hold families in the same enclosures, which Democrats have called cages. So sort of been part of our immigration system for far too long, and something I don't think any of us think is like, okay, we're not like... That was great, Obama. That's our favorite thing about your legacy.
It was great when Obama did it, like says nobody.
Yeah.
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 I really thought that moment where he said they're really well taken care of, like that took my breath away. That Same. Was such a stunning display of how evil he really is. Like,
well, that's why I really question anyone who's like, he was so much better. Like, just because he didn't like scream that yeah. in a like very high decibel, like that, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
that, like, I'm sorry, just because he can calmly say that the cages are great, like, no.
He's like, oh, yeah, by the way, those kids I kidnapped and then I like got and I lost the parents, they're taken care of well, at least. And it's like 60 of those kids, at least 60 of those kids. Were under the age of 5 when they were separated. They won't have any recollection of where they come from, of who their parents are. And
the trauma is irreversible. Yeah. It's irreversible
years.
Trauma. Like you can't.
And, mm-hmm.
Like there's and it's not just for them. If they have children, same. That'll go down for generations. Like please, it's it's insane. Like, this man is a sociopath and everyone just acts like we're debating between two regular people. Like, no, yeah. You might as well have pulled this person from, like, I don't know, an episode of like CSI Psychopaths.
The United States has a sordid history where we have done, you know, a lot of reprehensible things. I think that this will go on that list of reprehensible things. This is it. And the fact that he can't even, like, he says they're well taken care of. He can't even admit to, like, this was a mistake. We're doing all that we can to reunite these people. It's like, it's disgusting. It is disturbing.
Yeah. One of my, like, favorite things about this job is, like, things move so quickly that it's hard for us to, like, retain what's happened. But, like, because I, like, post speeches and stuff, I, like, watch them over and over again as I'm, like, clipping them and stuff. And I think about Kamala's convention speech all the time, where she said, she had this line, which is, like, we're going to remember this moment. People are going to ask us about this and, like, what it felt like. And we're going to have to tell them what we did and what it felt like. And I think about that, like, every day. And in a sense, it's sort of like, I don't want to say it's cool. It's not cool, but it's a big responsibility. Like, we have to be really present and take all of this in and not forget it. Because you're right. It's like family separation was happening. I don't want to get the amount of time wrong, maybe over a couple months. But doesn't matter the time period, because those children, thousands of them, are traumatized for life.
For life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it also, like, I know, because, I mean, we've all been covering this since the beginning of the administration. And I there was a different vibe, like, in the beginning when we started this. Like, there were things that you could laugh at. But then, like, he did put kids in cages and he did these horrible things that we were like, he will do. And, you know, that was debatable before it had happened. But I think that at this point it is just like the list of atrocities and the list of insane shit that he's done. Like, I think that we're all sort of living through a very, like, intense trauma, and it doesn't get recognized because it, like, crept up on us slowly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that clip, Trump also defended his administration's immigration detention policies by claiming that only people with the lowest IQ follow the law by showing up for court proceedings. That was another moment where he sort of started to say it, and they heard it in the clip. He's like, I hate to say it, but I'm gonna say it.
Mm-hmm. They're really, really low IQ individuals. Like, what was he trying to say? I think he might
he
have
was
been
trying to say that only he was trying to say that only dumb people follow the law is what he was trying to say.
That's how he looks at it. It goes back to him being like, I don't pay my taxes because I'm smart. That's what he thinks.
Mr. Law and Order, General Lieutenant Law and Order.
Asylum seekers want to become citizens. They are actually trying to go through a legal process to be here. No one who has the option to, like, be part of the U.S. legally is like, nah, I'd rather just be undocumented so that I can't, like, I can be deported at any time and I can't go to college and my kids have to be scared all the time. Like, no one wants that. These immigrants who come here, especially the ones seeking asylum, would much prefer to normalize their status.
Yeah.
It's always the Republicans who ascribe, like, horrible motives that, like, probably they would have if they were in certain situations. Like, if I were on welfare, I would exploit it. Like, if I were accepting, like, food stamps, I would, like, try to cheat the system. Like, actually, I don't think most people are trying to cheat the system. I think most people are trying to, like, get by, want to be safe, want to be secure, want to, like, have enough money to live without having to, like, I don't know, like, resort to crazy things,
work two jobs. The other thing is that was another, I think, really good moment for Joe Biden in the debate, was when they started talking about raising the minimum wage, and Trump is just, like, explicitly like, no, I don't want to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And it's like, that's really the closing line you want to end this campaign on, when every American knows, who especially one of the ones who work minimum wage jobs, know that they are not comfortable, know that they are reliant upon these government subsidies. And it's like, so it's like, this is your appeal to these voters? Like, this is how you're going to get these, like, and then he was like, oh, sometimes it works. It's like, that was just such a ridiculous moment.
Yeah, nobody, it's like, of course the cost of living varies, but nobody in Nebraska is going to be like, I don't need $15 an hour. That's too much. I'm fine.
Well, it's like, oh, I was going to vote for Joe Biden, but then he said he was going to give me a raise. So now I'm voting for Donald Trump. It's like, what?
My favorite meme of the moment is the TikToks of people being lower middle class, blue collar white workers when they hear Joe Biden's going to tax people who make over 400K and they like lose their mind. It's like, what are you doing? I mean, this is nothing new. Those kind of voters voting against their interest is nothing new, but I guess it is continually surprising that they aren't like, no, I just don't want taxes. I also don't care about all the hate and everything. And another big topic last night was race in America. So during this segment, Biden primarily highlighted how Trump has exacerbated racial tensions, and Biden acknowledged systemic racism. There were a few memorable moments here. Let's listen.
Continue on the issue of race. Mr. President, you've described the Black Lives Matter movement as a symbol of hate. You've shared a video of a man chanting white power to millions of your supporters. You've said that black professional athletes exercising their First Amendment rights should be fired. What do you say to Americans who say that kind of language from a president is contributing to a climate of hate and racial strife?
Well, you have to understand, the first time I ever heard of Black Lives Matter, they were chanting pigs in a blanket, talking about police, pigs, talking about our police, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon. I said, that's a horrible thing. And they were marching down the street. And that was my first glimpse of Black Lives Matter. I thought it was a terrible thing. As far as my relationships with all people, I think I have great relationships with all people. I am the least racist person in this room.
Well, what do you say to Americans who are concerned by that rhetoric?
I don't know what to say. I got criminal justice reform done and prison reform and opportunity zones. I took care of black colleges and universities. I don't know what to say. They can say anything. I mean, they can say anything. It makes me sad because I am the least racist person. I can't even see the audience because it's so dark. But I don't care who's in the audience. I'm the least racist person in this room.
Okay, Vice President Biden, Abraham, let me ask you very quickly, and then I have a follow-up question for you.
Abraham Lincoln here is one of the most racist presidents we've had in modern history.
I mean, my favorite part was when Joe Biden joked about him being Abraham Lincoln, and then Trump didn't get the joke at all and was like, what are you talking about? I never said that I was Abraham Lincoln. You're dumb. And it's like, no, Joe Biden just made a really funny joke about you.
And when he said that joke, what else he said in it? He was like, he's really racist. He's a racist person. He's a terrible person. He's like, he called me Abraham Lincoln. He's like not even addressing the fact that he was called racist. It's he was like, I take offense with the Abe Lincoln, sir.
He didn't understand the joke.
Because he didn't understand it, which is so annoying. Like,
yeah.
Like, it is a very funny joke for him to be like, well, we got Abe Lincoln over here.
Which Trump has compared himself to Abraham Lincoln. Repeatedly.
He did it 2 minutes earlier.
Maybe he forgot he had said that.
Sometimes he forgets the since. He means to say like since Abraham Lincoln, but sometimes he just includes Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump won the minority vote last night.
Let's talk about that. Do we think he won any votes last night?
We're not rushing
to say no.
Like, I don't want to say no. There are a lot of people out there. Maybe I watched like a focus group on MSNBC this morning with three undecided black voters in Georgia. Two of them, they all said they will vote. And I think one switched to Biden and two still were undecided. So like, I cannot wrap my head around, and they were like, it's so disappointing that these are our two choices. And like, I just can't wrap my head around like someone seeing that. So like, I don't want to rule out that someone decided to vote for Trump because of it.
Yeah, I think that if anyone came out of that, it watched that debate and is like, I'm going to vote for Trump now, I think that that person really was just looking for a reason to vote for Trump.
Yeah.
And felt like after the first debate, they didn't have one. And now because he behaved slightly better, they have that like salves them. But I think they were just a Trump voter in disguise anyway.
I think if you were an undecided voter who was really caring about the issues, like who was concerned about healthcare or concerned about like coronavirus, and cared about the issues and the responses, I think that they would switch to Biden, because Donald Trump didn't lay out any plans, didn't lay out any, you know, future for what he wants to do as president. It's basically like he made $3.5 million in China or whatever it was, and like just trying to like throw it. But 5% of the electorate is undecided. They're trying to get 5% of people to vote. So it's just about voter turnout anyways. And we are seeing insane, insane numbers for voter turnout. Like something like 50 million people have already voted. That's a good sign. I mean, I don't know. I think this fucking cake has been cooked and baked for like weeks, maybe months.
Well, the distinction between now and 2016 and the undecideds is that, like, I think Hillary had, unfortunately, like a lot more strikes against her. She was a lot more polarizing than Biden. Like, I think if people are comparing Biden and Trump, like, I do think that it slants slightly in favor of Biden at this point, based on his performance in the campaign, that he came across as like pretty steady. Biden, I'm talking about. And the fact that Trump, I think, has lost a little bit of his magic touch when it comes to like winning people over. I think it's just not what it used to be. And that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And his argument is the same as it has been, which is, I'm going to change everything and make things good again and drain the swamp. It's been 4 years and you haven't. And the thing Trump cannot grasp, that Joe Biden does not hold public office and has not for 4 years. He keeps saying, well, Joe Biden didn't do this. He's had a year and a half to do COVID. It's like, what are you talking about? He's a man. He's a private citizen. What is he supposed to do?
Well, also when he's like, Joe Biden didn't change anything when he was there, he didn't change anything. It's like, okay, you're president now.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
This
minute.
Also, I mean, nothing is funnier to me than when they bring up the swine flu.
Oh my God, I know.
It is crazy to me that no one on the team has been like, you know what? I don't think that the swine flu thing is sticking or resonating with people. I think it's actually making us look really bad.
Mm-hmm. I know. He just keeps giving them opportunities to say, actually, we did everything right.
It's so funny because he's like, well, if swine flu had been as bad as COVID, it would have been really bad. And it's like, but it wasn't.
For a reason.
Crazy. Like,
yeah. Oh, my God. For the final topic, because this is the first time in U.S. presidential history that climate change was featured at a debate, which is crazy, as like
just
an official
time.
Topic. Just in time. I know. Great. We're just starting to see the effects, so glad we're finally discussing this. But Biden made some waves by declaring that he wants to transition away from the oil industry over time. And Trump was like, oh my God, what a statement. And I think Biden misspoke slightly. I think what he meant to say was cut some subsidies and just disincentivize that kind of energy. Trump also claimed that Biden basically like wrote and loves the Green New Deal, which is not accurate.
Mm. I mean, it's fine to me if Biden wants to transition away from the oil industry over time. Right. That's also fine. So.
Well, he explained it well with the way he did the fracking, like how like you scale it back, but you figure out a way to capture the emissions that are being released. And it's like, and when you hear that, I'm like, that makes sense. You know what I mean? And this is another thing. It's like polling shows that Americans want to move away from our dependence upon oil and natural gas. We want clean air. Like, no one is fighting. Like people want to breathe. Like, it's such a crazy, like, oh, he doesn't want black smoke to be burned into the atmosphere and rip the ozone layer. Wow, that's radical. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump's just like, what are you going to do, Pennsylvania, like Western Pennsylvania voters? Like, I think he's literally just saying this for the sake of like very small pockets of the country that he wants to possibly win.
Yeah.
Biden wins Pennsylvania. He just needs to win a Michigan or an Arizona after that. And that's it. I think that's what's freaking him out. And it looks like Pennsylvania is
I feel good about Pennsylvania.
Sorry, Sammy. Sammy's like, don't talk about it.
Yeah. Breaking news. My parents just texted me that they are on their way to their polling place in Texas.
Amazing. Wow. Nice. I am excited about Texas.
I know. Mm-hmm. And you know what I thought was interesting in that oil answer? He was like, Texas, listen up, which made me be like, Trump knows that he's in fucking trouble in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Because normally, like, a Republican candidate would not need to speak directly to Texas. But he knows that he's in fucking trouble in Texas.
In Georgia, too. And, like, you can see, you're seeing where you can see where they're starting to throw their money. Biden's spending more money in Texas. Trump is like, oh, fuck, trying to spend more money in Georgia and Texas.
Biden has, like, more money than he can use.
Trump is spending more than he has at this point. And they are like,
well, that tracks.
Yeah.
An interesting take I saw was that, like, because the debate was like Trump's last chance to actually like take a stand and like sway people and he missed it. The fact that it like was sort of like an unremarkable like debate overall, I think that like is screwing him up even more because now he doesn't have money to like cure that by, you know, just pouring a ton of money into certain states. He like his campaign is just like kind of a mess internally. Everyone's like looking for new jobs. So I feel like that's kind of like maybe the takeaway that just like he didn't sway many people. Maybe he swayed a few, but like overall it was not, there was no narrative really in his favor.
Yeah, we have there weren't days. A lot of moments I can see them putting on an ad and them also having money to distribute those ads at this point. I also noticed a real difference in like their ability to actually be political about it. Because like you said, Trump kept being like, Texas, Pennsylvania, look at me. Biden would look at the camera and name half a dozen cities in Pennsylvania that I'd never heard of because he's been campaigning for like his whole life. He knows, he knows the cities in Texas that this actually impacts. So we'll wrap it up there.
Yeah, and we have 11 days, and who knows what's going to happen between now and then. So,
but I am very heartened that so many people have voted because, of course, 11 days, like anything could happen. You never know. Something could happen, but people are voting, and you can't change your vote. So that's good.
Reach out to people in your life. Make sure they're voting. Make sure they've got a plan.
Yes, and stick around. Stick around till the end of this episode where I interview Congresswoman Terry Sewell from Alabama about voting, about women's rights, about meeting the Obamas before they even knew each other. It was so fun. She was so delightful to have on and is like one of my favorite congresswomen. So stick around for that chat.
Hello, and welcome back to the Betches Up podcast. I'm Amanda Dubrin, and I am back today with Representative Terry Sewell. Congressman Sewell represents Alabama's 7th District in the House of Representatives, where she has served since 2011. Thank you so, so much for joining us, Congresswoman.
Thank you so much. It's great to be a part of your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you? How are you feeling today, this Friday before? We're about 10 days out. Right? I know.
No, I'm actually very excited. Having watched the debate last night, I thought that Joe Biden really was speaking directly to the American people. Love the fact that he made sure that everyone knows that he will be a president for all Americans, whether you voted for him or not. I think that that's so important. I think that, you know, we need a president that's going to unite us and not further divide us like this administration has done from day one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we know that 50 million Americans have already voted. So people, a lot of people have their minds made up. But were you happy with sort of the closing message that Biden presented last night?
I was. I thought that it was the perfect closing argument. It's about restoring integrity. It's about restoring decency back into the White House. It's about repairing our relationships abroad. You know, I sit on the House Intelligence Committee, and I can tell you that our national security has suffered from the fact that our allies don't feel like they can trust us. And, you know, this is a president that has cozied up to dictators like Putin. And I think that it's so important that we remember who our allies are and who will help defend us in case of any breach of national security. These very countries that he's cozying up to are the very ones that are trying to sow seeds of discord in our elections. They're the ones who are trying to, hack into our election security and trying to mess us up. So look, I think that I think that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's administration will be the administration that will make us proud. And when I think about the fact that Joe came out of retirement to run, why? Because we thought, and from day one, you know, I represent Alabama, not quite a progressive state, but that's okay. I'm a lone progressive voice in that state. Yeah. You know, I just thought that Joe could, given his years of service and the fact that he's worked across the aisles and the fact that he is authentically who he is. You know, Joe makes no mistakes about the fact that that he may slip up. There may be a gap. But the reality is that I think all of us know his heart and we know that he will put America first and he will really restore the soul of this nation.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe you are pretty longtime friends with both of the Obamas. Has it been fun to see them out stumping again?
Absolutely. You know, I had the great pleasure of going to college with Michelle Robinson, as I knew her then, and then to go to law school with Barack Obama. You know, I had the great pleasure of being the only member of Congress when they were serving that knew them before they knew each other. So that was pretty cool. You know, at the end of the day, I think that we long for a president like Barack Obama. We long for that administration, the decency of that administration. You know, we're sick of fact-checking every time the president opens up his, President Trump opens his mouth up. And, you know, I think that we've really kept these fact-checkers employed over the last 4 years.
I know. Truly, truly. Speaking of live fact-checking and discouraging the sort of misinformation, a lot of what the president has done is about voting. So I'd love to jump into a topic that highlights a really present issue for all of us and is one hitting home for you. So this week, the Supreme Court granted the request of Alabama's Secretary of State and Attorney General to block a lower court ruling that would have allowed counties to offer curbside voting because of the pandemic. What does this mean for Alabama voters? And how does it highlight what's at stake with the Supreme Court confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett?
You know, I am not only a very proud Alabamian, I actually am representing my home district. My district includes Birmingham, Montgomery, and my hometown of Selma, Alabama. I dare say it is the civil rights district of America. And when I think about the fact that people like John Lewis shed a little blood on a bridge in my hometown for the equal right of every American to vote, it is not only deeply disturbing, it is downright un-American that the Supreme Court will be ruling, especially during the midst of this pandemic, to uphold a ban on curbside voting in Alabama. Curbside voting is an option intended to accommodate those who are disabled and our senior citizens, those who are especially at risk because of this virus. In the middle of a pandemic, we should be making it easier for voters to exercise that fundamental right to vote and not more difficult. I am so afraid that the Supreme Court nomination by President Trump of Amy Barrett, you know, will further tilt the court in the wrong direction. You know, when I think about all of the things that happened in the 1960s, from the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to the Civil Rights Act of 64 to the Fair Housing Act of 68, you know, it was really federal oversight and the federal judiciary, which really upheld and provided the kind of check and balance on the executive branch as well as the legislative branch, you know. Yeah, in so many of those landmark cases. And when I think about the fact that it was a young Republican judge, a judge that was nominated by Eisenhower, Frank Johnson in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama, that had the courage to do what the law needed him to do, and that was to provide an injunction so that those marchers could march safely from Selma to Montgomery with federal troopers by their sides. You know, we're going backwards and not forwards. Unfortunately, I believe old battles have become new again. Just stressing the importance of what's at stake in this election. You know, our democracy is at stake and on the ballot for the 2020 election. No person should be sitting on the sidelines. Voting rights is fundamental to all of us. Our voice is our vote, and none of us should let our voices be silenced in this election.
And looking forward on how we can maybe address this in the future, as you mentioned, it's odd to hear people like Judge Barrett refer to voting rights as policy questions or racial issues as policy questions when you've seen the court protect them and take those steps in the past. Since the Supreme Court gutted key parts of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, which obviously has a lot of rich history from your district, You've sponsored legislation to restore it numerous times, over and over again. I just imagine it's like on your to-do list every year. It's like, all right, we got to do this again. Can you remind our listeners, like, what happens after you and your colleagues in the House pass that? And how would a Biden presidency and a Democratic Senate impact future attempts?
Yes. You know, since the Shelby versus Holder decision in 2013, which found unconstitutional Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which was the formula to determine which states have had a history of voter discrimination and thus should have any changes in their laws pre-cleared by the Justice Department. That Section 5 is the enforceability. So the enforceability is there, but Section 4 is gone. So what the Supreme Court did is they challenged Congress to come up with a modern day formula by which to determine which states have had a history of voter discrimination. So my bill that I have been working on for the last 6 years and introducing, as you said, in the last three Congresses. Finally, in 2018, the American people put a check on the Trump administration by electing a House Democratic majority. Yay! Yeah. And finally, H.R. 4, we named it H.R. 4 because we're restoring Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. H.R. 4 passed the House of Representatives December 6th and was sent over to the Senate side, which it languished on the desk of Mitch McConnell along with so many other bipartisan bills. And in fact, our bill was bipartisan. We had a Republican congressman out of Pennsylvania that also voted for our bill. But, you know, the reality is that until we get a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democrat in the White House, mm-hmm. can we fully restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965? We've been living under not having the full protections of the Voting Rights Act and lack of federal oversight. And what we saw immediately after the Shelby versus Holder decision, 25 states, including the state of Alabama, instituted more restrictive voting laws. Many of those states were covered jurisdictions that would have had to have those voting laws, reviewed by the Justice Department. They purposely waited until after the Shelby versus Holder decision in order to institute them. And the state like Alabama made it more difficult to vote and not less difficult to vote. It used to be that you could have 15 forms of ID to vote in Alabama. My dad in his latter years had a massive stroke and couldn't drive or walk, and he was wheelchair bound. But he used to vote with a validly issued federal ID called a Social Security card. Everybody has them, widely available, but they didn't have a photo on it. But, you know, clearly people need to be able to identify who they are in order to vote. But we're making decisions. State legislatures are making decisions as to who will have a easier time voting by choosing what kinds of ID can be shown. Some states have, like Alabama, you can show your fishing license or gun license or gun permit license, but you can't show an ID from a state university.
Oh my
Those
God.
Are the kinds of things that are really just incredulous. And the fact that the Supreme Court in the middle of this pandemic is not seeing that some of those restrictions should be relaxed in the midst of this pandemic. No one's saying that one shouldn't have to, you know, prove who they are in order to vote. But we are saying that we should be making it easier to vote. Therefore, we should have more polling station, not less. These long lines that we're seeing in early voting, that's a form of modern day voter suppression. We no longer have to count how many marbles are in a jar, but we do still have modern day forms of voter suppression that's alive and well that need to be checked. I know that a Biden-Harris administration will take within its first 100 days the restoration of the Voting Rights Act, and I look forward to being there to help them pass it.
Yes, totally. As you mentioned, you're a bright blue light in a pretty red state. In fact, you were the first African-American woman to have been elected to Congress from Alabama when you did assume office. As you mentioned, you know, because people refer to Alabama as a red state, even maybe candidates ignore it's the Democratic progressive voters there because it's just considered such a red state. But Alabama is also represented in the Senate with one Democrat right now, Senator Doug Jones. Yeah. Absolutely. And I wonder if you could speak about how meaningful and important that actually is to have, you know, a Democratic senator partner with you and you representing that area and why it is still so important and valuable to, you know, not just say Alabama's a red state and that's we assume that we are defeated there. Why is it so important to continue to have a partner and a strong presence in Congress for Alabama?
Very good question. You know, Doug Jones got elected in 2017 with a strong coalition. He overperformed in my district, which is the only Democratic district in the state of Alabama. But he also had an amazing coalition of suburban women, moderate Republicans, and independents that really came together, showing that, you know, Alabama can be purple in certain instances. And he's working hard to get that same coalition out again this election. And we're helping him do that. You know, it was the Black women vote that was so pivotally strong for Doug in the 2017 election. You know, Doug has been an amazing partner with me. Prior to that, I had a bit of trouble trying to get my colleagues on the Senate side to take up some of my bills, like the Voting Rights Restoration Act and other bills that were so critically important. But Doug came in, and in 2.5 years, he rolled up his sleeve. He's passed 21 bills. He's been an original co-sponsor on the voting rights bill, my bill. He's also helped me to secure additional funding for HBCUs, more money for rural Alabama, really rural America, for wastewater and sewer treatment, which is so critically important. He's also helped widows with survivorship tax issue that had been, you know, stymied on the Senate side for many years. He got that passed. You know, Doug has proven that he is about one Alabama. He's putting people of Alabama first, which is what you would want your elected officer, elected officials to be able to do. So he's earned the right to come back. You know, I really think that it's going to be really important that we understand that our vote does matter, even in Ruby red states like Alabama, that we can turn the tide. And if we can turn a red state like Alabama blue statewide, we can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just, it's so important to consider when you, you know, I'm sure people think, well, I live in Alabama and Alabama always goes this way for president, but your vote, their votes can so move the needle on these things you're talking about that have a cascade effect in the rooms where it happened. It's so important.
Absolutely. And you know, when I think about my constituents, the number one issue in the state of Alabama is expanding Medicaid and health care. That's what they're talking about on the stump. When I'm out and about socially distanced, wearing my mask and talking to my constituents, they're saying to me, you know, it's states like Alabama, those 14 states that didn't expand Medicaid, where we're seeing rural hospitals closing, where we're seeing so many working families lose their health care in the middle of this pandemic. And we see this administration going to court to take away people's health care. And that's one reason why they're rushing through Judge Barrett's nomination, is because they know on November 10th, they will take, the Supreme Court will take up the Affordable Care Act and its constitutionality. So much is at stake in this election. No one should be on the sidelines in this election. I hope that they will go to the polls and vote for Democrats up and down the ballot.
Me too. Which reminds me, last night, Trump did say, even though during the end of the hearing, some Senate Republicans were saying, no, ACA is fine. I think Trump said during the debate, I do hope that the Supreme Court overturns it. So that's where we are with that.
And they have not come up after 61 votes in Congress to uphold or to take away the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans in the last 12 years still have not come up with a replacement. The reality is that health care should be a right in this amazing country we live in, not a privilege for the few. It should be a right for everyone to have access to affordable health care. And that's what we should do, to try to characterize you know, the need for affordable health care writ large as something that's anti-American is just wrong. You know, I think that Biden has cleared up this misconception that he's going to try to take away people's health care. If you have your health care, you should keep your health care. But a public option would give those who are spending too much money on health care an opportunity to have subsidized health care. And it's a choice, and we deserve to have that choice. When I think about Alabama's bare bone minimum Medicaid program, in fact, an individual, a working mom with two children, has to make as little as $4,000 a year, not a month, yearly in Alabama just to qualify for bare bone Medicaid. Wow. We need to expand Medicaid in Alabama. Doug Jones has been a great partner with me in that, and I know that Biden-Harris will totally work to shore up the Affordable Care Act.
So this is a very big picture question, but I find, you know, we're always in emergency mode with this president, and some of the issues that are so important to all of us aren't always the top issue of the day. But big picture, what is at stake for women and women's rights this election, and how do those stakes get higher for women of color?
You know, when I think about the fact that this, that old battles have become anew again, that's not just true for voting rights. You know, I look at my mom, who was the first African-American woman to be on the city council in Selma, a great role model for me, but it was her generation that fought for reproductive rights for women, and her generation that really tried to really move the needle in a positive direction. They ushered in the first women elected across the board, you know, in such great numbers. But we're still struggling to try to make sure that women have the equal right to control their own bodies. We're still struggling to make sure that pay equity is top of mind in any administration, that you know, women should get paid for equal pay for equal worth, you know, and equal work. That's so critically important. And it has been shown that it's when women issues are being addressed that we see greater movement in so many issues that affect our family, everything from healthcare to childcare. You know, when women succeed, America succeeds. That's just the bottom line. And I know that a Biden-Harris administration will take that to heart. I know that that Biden has been a big champion for women's rights. You know, after all, he was the one who was a key sponsor for Violence Against Women's Act, which was such an important act that set up these domestic violence courts that really helped to protect women and our families against domestic violence. The same is true with Kamala Harris, who's not only an amazing stateswoman, but she's also my sorority sister, and I'm wearing pink in her honor as a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. And as a proud alumni of HBCUs, I think that so much is at stake for women, for people of color, and I believe that the Biden-Harris administration will really put our issues top of mind and move our issues. After the end of the day, our issues are American issues. They're issues that are of value for human rights and civil rights and women's rights and labor rights. These are American values that we're fighting for that are so critically important.
And finally, as you mentioned, your mother was the first Black woman elected to the Selma City Council. You have a bunch of firsts in your biography. I think you've written books about Black women's political power and influence. It seems like public service and a sense of duty is, they've always played a big role in your life. We have a lot of listeners who are voting for the first time this year. So I was wondering if you could sort of, if your first experience voting was memorable in any way and how you felt at the time.
Well, the first time that I actually was involved in a political campaign, I was a campaign manager for my mother's first council. You could kind of say that public service is in my blood. You know, I think that people should realize that your vote matters. The fact that if you don't vote, that matters. I mean, it's your inaction that's actually allowing others to control your voice. In this representative government, your voice is your vote. And no one's voice should be silenced. When I think about a young John Lewis, and we renamed my bill HR 4, it's now the John Robert Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2020 in his honor. He was a young man, in college at the time. My mom's words, when my mom, who's a librarian by vocation, as well as a PK, a preacher's kid, she's always good for a Bible verse and for a good
book. Yeah.
But she says that you can bloom where you're planted. Bloom where you're planted. I say to all those first-time voters out there, you can make a difference right where you are. We as Americans make a pact in this democracy, and that pact is fortified by your vote. That is how we in this representative democracy actually make sure that our voices are heard. So don't think that you can't make a difference right where you are. Your vote matters in every election, federal, state, and local. And as John Lewis said, the vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool in our democracy. Let's use it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Congresswoman, and for your tireless efforts to protect voting rights for all of us. We really appreciate it. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman, and this is the Betches Sup Podcast.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Sean Kilby and Amanda Duberman. Our podcast managers are Mike Coscarelli and Sean Kilby. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Artwork by Brittany Levine. Be sure to follow us at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send your emails to sup@betches.com.
Betches.